call the first case, which is 00-2473 Karen Bammert versus Darn Supervalu Inc. And we will hear first from Brian H. Sand, representing Karen Bammert. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please this honorable court, my distinguished colleague, Mr. Steens. My name is Brian Sonda, and I am one of the attorneys representing the petitioner, Karen Bammert, in this action. The issue presented to this court today is whether the public policy exception to the employment at will doctrine applies when an employee is terminated because of their spouse's conduct in fulfilling their legal obligations, in this case, as a law enforcement officer. The posture that this case comes into this court is upon a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim that was granted by the circuit court and subsequently affirmed in an unreported decision from the Court of Appeals. As this court knows, on a motion to dismiss, the facts as pled are deemed admitted, and the inferences concerning the liberally construed pleadings are drawn in favor of the non-moving party, in this case, my client, Ms. Bammert. Briefly, those facts are that Karen Bammert was an assistant manager for Don Supervalu Grocery Store for over 25 years, and that she was terminated by her employer in retaliation for Ms. Bammert's spouse, a law enforcement officer for the city of Menominee, Wisconsin, having participated in the investigation and arrest of Ms. Bammert's boss's wife, Nona Williams. The public policy exception to the at-will employment doctrine was first set forth by this court in Brockmeyer versus Dun and Bradstreet. An employee has a cause of action for wrongful discharge when they are terminated, when their termination is contrary to a fundamental and well-defined public policy as evidenced by existing law. Those fundamental public policies can be found in the Constitution, in our statutes, and in administrative laws. But furthermore, this court recognized in the Winkleman, Wandry, and most recently the Straczynski decisions that the public policy foundation for a wrongful termination suit can be determined by the spirit as well as the letter of the law, and that there can be implicit in the law that public policy foundation. An employer can violate that public policy exception to the employment at will doctrine in one of two recognized ways. First, if the employer terminates the employee for refusing to violate their directive or command, which would violate the public policy law. That was recognized by the court in Bushko and Kempfer. But second, when the law imposes an affirmative obligation upon an employee to take a certain course of conduct, and they are terminated as a result of that conduct, then that too comports with this court's recognized exception to the employment at will doctrine.
Counsel, let me just ask you now, those cases you cited, where did the public policy violation occur? When was it within the industry in which the person was employed, say like in Kempfer, which I happened to write a few years ago, but was it within the industry or outside of the industry?
In Kempfer, I believe it was within the industry. In that case, there was a truck driver who refused to undertake driving a truck, and he didn't have the appropriate commercial license. So
commercial driver's license.
That's correct.
What's the difference? Isn't there a difference in your case?
I don't think that there's a distinction.
Well, okay. Would you agree or disagree that the public policy violation takes place outside of the zone of employment?
Outside of the zone of the employment of Ms. Bammert, yes.
And that's where the discharge took place. Do you think that's a legitimate difference that would distinguish your case from, say, the ones that you cited? There, you know, you have the Wandry case or Kempfer or Hausman or Straczynski or even the Tachi case, but they were all within that zone.
I don't think that that is a distinction that this court should recognize. Let me explain
why. Why not?
The public policy exception applies to the discharge when the discharge is contrary to the public policy exception or the public policy that is the rationale for the discharge, if you will. And let me posit an example, and I'll use the Hausman case. Houseman is where this court recognized public policy exception when an employee is supposed to report violations of abuse in a nursing home. Take, for example, that similar scenario, but the Houseman, a plaintiff, works for two nursing homes that are unrelated, different companies, Nursing Home A and Nursing Home B.
It's still in the same industry. I mean, I guess the example I was throwing out was that the public policy I think you're looking at here was a public policy that maybe people should not drive drunk, or it was outside of any, there wasn't any relational industry. We're talking about police work versus working in a grocery store.
I understand, Your Honor. So maybe I'll change my analogy to say she's working as a nursing home assistant for one employer, and she is working as an accountant on the side in some other circumstance. And so different industries. But the question is, if that person in the Houseman example does the affirmative reporting, and then in a separate, perhaps even unrelated context, has an employer that believes, we don't want to have that kind of person working for us. We don't want to have a whistleblower. We don't want to have somebody that's not going to follow our game plan. We should fire them. That complies with the public policy exception to the employment at will doctrine.
Counsel, let me follow up on Justice Wilcox's question concerning outside the zone. Take this case rather than Houseman modified. Take this case modified. That is, let's say the officer makes the arrest during the day, and it's the officer who has a night job. And the night job is the night manager at the supermarket. Now, that's an example where the violation of public policy takes place outside the zone of the employment subject to discharge. Does that outside of the zone make any difference in the analysis?
I don't think so one bit. I think, just to continue with that example, if Officer Bammert was the employee of the grocery store part-time, and Officer Bammert, under those circumstances, was discharged as a result of his lawful obligations as a law enforcement officer, then that he would, in fact, have a remedy under the employment, under the exception to the employment at will doctrine. And perhaps a reason to support that proposition is you have to actually look for the rationale in Brockmeyer itself and its progeny. The employee retains some measure of job security versus an employer's termination when that termination is brought about by the person's compliance with the fundamental public policy. The employee is relieved of the burden of choosing between two bad alternatives: comply with the law and have some kind of punitive action taken against you in an employment context, or fail to comply with the law and not fulfill the important public policy as espoused by the statutes, in this case, potentially jeopardize public safety. And so allowing an employer to harm the law-abiding person's spouse is tantamount to harming that person themselves. This court has supported the legislature in allowing employees to seek redress for fulfilling their fundamental legal obligations and provided that employee with a remedy. And this court ought not allow employers to get around Brockmeyer and his progeny by doing indirectly what they cannot do directly. In this particular fact scenario, you do not want law enforcement officials faced with the Hobson's choice of not investigating crimes and participating in arrests, and allowing, therefore, the potential danger to public safety, or fulfilling the obligations of their law enforcement duties and risking the harm, in this case, to them, to their spouse.
So in other words, if Brockmeyer is a narrow exception, and I've been on the court 10 years, and we've handled, as you know, several of these cases, and most of the time we have widened, broadened the narrow exception, although in each case we say this is a narrow exception. What is the logical stopping point of this type of relationship? You say in your brief that it should be to promote marriage and Let me ask you, well, what if it's, if they're not married, but they've been living together for 20 years, is that not the same? Or is that because we, it's a statutory requirement, or we have the recognition of marriage? What difference does it make if it was your son or your daughter? Because it seems to me you're looking at, or if it was, instead of being 3 months from when this took place, it was 2 years and 9 months, and you still plead the same that this person, he or she, is being terminated because of this arrest that took place.
I have a couple of kind of multi-tiered responses. First,
well, I guess I'm not saying, well, where's your line? Where do we stop in this area, if we do at all?
Ms. Bammert would not, at least in the context of this case, argue to the court that it should apply, that this exception should apply to persons other than spouses, because that's the facts of this case, and the facts of it, perhaps another case may be called upon by the court in a different context to actually address that question. But if the court were to answer that hypothetical additional argument in advance in this case, I believe that there are distinctions to be made by this court between someone who is in fact married and some other possible close relationship with a boyfriend or girlfriend or a sibling or something of that, along those lines. Spouses do enjoy a variety of unique legal benefits in this state that are not afforded to other types of relationships. The laws do protect the sanctity of marriage. One example is the spousal testimonial privilege, types of privileges that are afforded to spouses and not others.
Well, I was just thinking we afford this to domestic partnerships. I mean, would that be also fall into this category?
Certainly possible that the court would choose to protect that kind of a relationship. Also possible that the court would say no. And let me suggest some reasons for that. First, in a marriage as opposed to some kind of other blood relationship, the relationship is voluntary. One doesn't pick one's blood relatives, and you may or may not have a close relationship that can be harmed by an employer vis-a-vis that relationship. But the fact that the individuals are married themselves and are married at the time of the termination is a good proxy for this court to utilize as some kind of objective verification of the closeness of the relationship that could be harmed. That's not to say that that employee who brings the cause of action will win. And I think that goes to your later question about what if they were terminated 3 years after Officer Bammert had conducted this activity. Or indeed, to further that line of argument, what if they were married but separated for the last 3 years and hadn't spoken to one another? Ms. Bammert just wants the ability to present her case in court. She's not been afforded that yet. However, if she were allowed to do so because of her unique status as a marriage, it's possible that she may lose, and those would be factual distinctions that a jury could use to determine that she was not terminated as a result of that spousal.
So you're suggesting that that if a couple, married couple, isn't getting along, that for a period of time they're not living together, they're still married, and maybe they have a relationship, but it isn't as strong, that this was... Doesn't that really make it rather difficult? You'd have to look into whether they're getting along, whether they're living together, how the marriage is. If there's a divorce ongoing, you're saying, well, that's something maybe we wouldn't look at. Is that something we really want to get into?
Well, what the court should be concerned about is whether this is a recognized exception at all as a threshold question. And certainly after that, that employee would bear the burden of proof in that, in fact, they were violated as a result of their spouse's activities, and that it was in retaliation for that. And on those kinds of extreme circumstances that you posited, the employer may very well have a viable defense, but that would be a fact question for a jury to determine.
Well, your position is decide this case. If it gets out of hand later on, we can put a stop to it.
Certainly a jury could put a stop to it under those extreme circumstances, and it may be appropriate for summary judgment as well. But the threshold question is, will this
exception be extended to what typically is recognized by this court as a unique and close relationship, and that what an employer cannot do under the dictates of Brockmeyer, that they could do an end around and do by virtue of harming that spouse.
Could I ask you, is there any authority to recognize a wrongful discharge for activity that took place outside the zone of employment?
I'm not aware of any case that has addressed that question. But for the reasons that I suggested, I think that the focus has to be on the rationale or the reason for the termination. One other point to make about why the type of retaliation against a spouse may be very different than a live-in boyfriend or girlfriend or some other sibling, and that is the economic harm that is visited on the person in Mr. or Officer Brockmeyer's position. An employer who seeks retaliation for a person's compliance with the public policy can directly, in fact, visit financial harm on that person by virtue of firing the spouse. In this state, we are a community property state, and so the spouse's interest has a legal interest by virtue of the law in their spouse's income and a legal entitlement to that income. So that is another unique distinction that could be made for why you would apply this to spouses and not some other type of familial relationship.
Counsel, indeed, that argument that discharge is an economic event that affects not only the employee, but also the employee's income and therefore the spouse's income, especially in a state where we have 766 marital property, presumptively marital, in a spousal relationship. So there may be good reason to limit this exception to just a spouse. But what about the rest of the equation? Are you, in your statement of the issue, I think you don't limit it to police officers. Are you asking that we're talking that this case be limited to police officers and as well as spouses of police officers?
I think the proposition, police officer is the context in which this case arises, and that's the relationship that we utilize to determine the important public policy exception in this case. But the proposition, I think, is whether or not a spouse is discharged as a result of their spouse's compliance with the public policy law, not necessarily just within the context of law enforcement.
Is there something you know, if you read our cases, I think it's fair to say we walk very gingerly, or try to walk very gingerly in this area of employment at will, and try, and hopefully succeed, to be narrow, 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 narrow. What makes police officer unique, if at all, so that we could narrow this whole thing? You're telling me that if this is going to apply to someone who audits for the Wisconsin Department of Revenue, that person's spouse, someone who checks cheese for the Department of Agriculture, and that person's spouse, I mean, are we going into this? Can my husband, who's a lawyer, would it apply to his discharge because someone, God forbid, didn't like my opinions? I mean, is that what you're asking for? Everything from cheese to justices.
The reason why this is such a narrow exception is because the extremely limited circumstances that this court allows to rise to the level of that fundamental public policy exception. And so that is the gate, if you will, to stem what I think is Mr. Steen's argument that, gee, if you open this up, perhaps it's a floodgate situation with all kinds of lawsuits. That is the gate that would remain and remains narrow. It's not easy for an employee to show that they were terminated as a result of that narrow type of situation. And so the second, of course, is that this court could choose, obviously, to take the law enforcement sphere concept and raise that upon a pedestal that's even higher than any other type of public policy violation.
If the inference that you're asking us to use is that this happened outside of the zone, so to speak, therefore that's the reason that so-and-so got fired. That's the cause. So that could happen in many, many, as Justice Bradley indicated, in many, many different situations. What you're suggesting to us is, maybe as the Chief suggested, well, let's just look at this and not worry about the others, but we do have to worry about the others because we're writing for the whole state, so to speak, and we're looking at this, and if we put out the signal that you win, but we're going to limit it just to police officers, that doesn't seem to be as rational as saying, well, no, there could be many other situations that we might have to look at once we open this up.
I do believe that the appropriate analytical line is if the spouse, if the person who undertakes this lawful activity to comply with the dictates of their legal obligations, if they had been the employee and they had been terminated, and the court would recognize that under those circumstances they would have a cause of action by virtue of the exception of the employment at will doctrine, then in those narrow circumstances it would apply to their spouse. Their spouse is terminated for the exact same reason.
Those don't seem, well, maybe I'm missing it, but are those really narrow circumstances you recommend?
Certainly. I mean, that has been the basis for many of the decisions that have come forth since Brockmeyer, that there are a number of cases that are simply rejected because they weren't able to define this well-articulated fundamental public policy.
Well, let me see if I can find an articulate public policy. I'm looking at Section 943.30 of the criminal statutes. And it says, I'm not going to read all of it, I'm just going to pick out the words I want to pick out, so that'll make you suspicious. Whoever, either verbally or by any written or printed communication, threatens somebody of a crime, we're not doing that, or offense, or threatens to commit any injury to the person, property, business, profession, calling, or trade, and I'm interested, injury to the person or property, with intent thereby to extort money, that's not involved here, or with intent to compel the person so threatened to do any act against the person's will or omit to do any lawful act. Got the picture? Well, I'm going to put it to where when Miss Williams is charged, is arrested or stopped for drunk driving, she says, oh, I recognize you, Officer Bammert. Your wife works for my husband. I don't think you ought to charge me because it's not going to be very good for your wife, and this is a marital property state, and the presumption is that to have her salary is yours, so it's not too good for you either. That's a threat. It might be a crime to do that under this 943.30. That would be non-permissible. Or you could do it otherwise and say, you know, Officer Bammert, your wife works for my husband, and I bet she could use a raise in her salary. And we're a marital property state, and half of that's yours, you know. That's a bribe. That wouldn't be kosher either, would it?
No, no.
Would violate public policy, right?
Certainly.
So it doesn't happen that way. What happens is it's implicit that here you have the wife of an employer. And implicit in this whole relationship is that there could be retribution. And guess what? There might be. You haven't proved that, so it may be that these are two totally unrelated events, right? Just happened within a couple of months of each other, but they could be totally unrelated. You've got a burden of them here. So what happens is that this is now done after the fact, should that change anything? I know you don't quite make that argument. You make a similar kind of argument, but not quite that argument.
I think that the analogy that the court poses is proving the point of why you have the public policy exception to the doctrine in the first place, which is you don't want people to be making sort of these Hobson's choices. Certainly not a law enforcement officer in a small community who's out on the street. And to address Justice Wilcox's sort of floodgate argument, and isn't this going to be something beyond something that's narrow, I don't know many circumstances when a employer has a problem with their employee's spouse such that the fulfillment of that spouse's legal obligations would make the employer want to exercise control over their spouse for retaliatory purposes. Law enforcement, I suppose, would be one of those circumstances, especially when you have officers out in a small community. Perhaps when you've got, again, probably in a small community, two employees that are spouses that are employees of the same employer. But frankly, not a lot of other circumstances. And this is the first time in after almost 20 years since the Brockmeyer decision that this has come to the court. I'd also suggest that if the court were to grant Ms. Bammert's day in court, that the hope of all causes of action is that it would act as a deterrent effect, and that the result of the decision would be there wouldn't be these circumstances having taken place, and employers would not be discharging for those improper reasons to begin with.
Suppose Officer Bammert hadn't been working the night of the arrest, but his wife was still discharged. Same result?
No. And again, this gets back to the employee having to show that the genesis for the termination was a well-defined public policy exception. It may be a variation that on that same theme. Officer Brockmeyer, off-duty capacity, working a private security for a concert. And Nona Williams is there, and in his capacity as doing private security, he believes she's being unruly and asks her to leave. A month or two later, his spouse is discharged. Well, in that case, Ms. Bammert, I don't believe, would be able to find the kind of public policy, fundamental public policy distinctions that can be found in, for example, our drunk driving laws. And so you wouldn't have a cause of action.
You mean to say that drunk driving is a fundamental public policy, but disorderly conduct is not?
In his capacity as a police officer versus just a private citizen, I think there's a significant distinction to be made in those two circumstances. And so, again, not a broadening or a massive expansion to what this court already recognizes. This court should recognize that an employer's retaliation against a person for complying with a fundamental public policy by terminating that person's spouse is actionable wrongful termination pursuant to the public policy exception to the at-will employment doctrine. The underlying rationale for the rule espoused in Brockmeyer and its progeny is served by protecting the spouse's employee and at least allowing them their day in court.
Thank you, counsel. Your time is up, and we will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Representing Don Supervag of Inc. is Philip Stevens.
Good morning. I'm Phil Steens from the firm Philip M. Steens, SC, Menominee, Wisconsin, and I represent the defendant respondent on SuperValue. The decision of the Court of Appeals should be affirmed. This honorable court should reject the petitioner's attempt to further expand public policy exception to the at-will employment doctrine. There are at least three good reasons why you should do that. First of all, to reverse the Court of Appeals in this case would, in effect, overrule Brockmeyer's rejection almost 20 years ago of the bad faith theory which was considered there. Secondly, to reverse will not effectively deter employers' future violations of either of the public policies that are mentioned by the petitioner. And thirdly, to reverse, as some of you have already contemplated, will inevitably lead to an ever-increasing number of wrongful discharge cases. Brockmeyer created the exception to the at-will no reason necessary rule And when this court did so, you rejected one of the theories that was considered in other states, which was the good faith in employment contract theories.
Counsel, what's wrong with your opposing counsel's argument that, look, we're going to, this is just a narrow exception, we're going to limit it to this public policy dealing with, primarily with this situation, police officers, drunken driving, perhaps disorderly conduct, specifically for that, and dealing specifically with the spousal husband relationship?
As Justice Bradley has pointed out, you've said that repeatedly, and yet here we are, and all these other cases have been here. And how, when you were saying we narrowly limit this to this particular case, stop another counsel from coming forward 6 months from now with a different factual situation and saying just this one more increment?
Well, now, don't we have a public policy you can't bribe or threaten a government official relating to doing his or her job?
Sure.
Clear cut, right?
Yes.
Okay. You can either threaten them ahead of time or at the time, or you can promise them at the time, or you can do it indirectly after the fact. And if we would hold the way you wish, that tells everybody in this state, everybody who will read this opinion on our internet or otherwise, will tell everybody in the state, okay, you don't have to threaten them at that time. You don't have to bribe them at that time. What you do is you take care of it later, after the fact. And after the fact, you can get retribution in one form or other. Teach this guy a good lesson, and you won't be punished.
My problem with that is that it only looks at one side of the employment, the employer-employee relationship. That sort of assumes that all employers are malicious and all employees are good employees. And I think that you have to look at both sides of the equation.
Sure, and if this woman was not a good employee, you had every right to fire her, right?
Yes.
In fact, you had every right to fire her for any grounds except one, violating public policy.
That's what the at-will employment
That's exactly right. So in a very narrow area, your rights to fire are limited. The public policy stuff. So, I guess I'm not so concerned whether it's a spouse or a partner or a sister. I think the question is, objectively, would a reasonable government official be threatened or bribed by this activity?
Well, and I thought about that, and it seems to me that's an awful cynical viewpoint about the character of public officials, law enforcement officers, judges, whomsoever, who might be placed in that situation. There is also a public policy that they're supposed to carry out their duty properly.
That's right. I'm not cynical. I think that everybody does try. I just think that one of the goals of 94330 is not to raw human. That means we have frailties. And the objective is not to put barriers before somebody to do the job, or to encourage them not to do the job. So I'm not cynical. I'm a realist and a pragmatist. And just following the law of 94330 that says, hey, we don't want this kind of conduct.
I beg to differ.
And you have every right to do that.
Counsel, what have other states done in this area? The question was asked of your opposing counsel based on what the case law has to say. Have other states gone outside of this so-called zone that we tried to define here?
With regard to those states who have accepted the public policy theory, I know of no state that has done it. If there is one, I'm just not aware of it.
Mr. Steens, I want to try to
understand your argument a little bit better by sharpening this question. I hope it doesn't. Assume that Mrs.
Bamert,
that Mrs. Bamert was a part-time police officer as well, was working at Don Super Value, and she was the one that had accomplished this arrest and had arrested Don's wife. And so Don fires her for that. Is there any debate here as to whether or not that constitutes a violation of public policy, or would you believe that that does not violate public policy?
I think that under those circumstances, Ms. Bamert would probably have a cause of action under the law as it's presently recognized in the state.
Okay.
But what you're being asked to do here is to move into a whole new sphere.
I understand that. And in fact, as I look at this case, correct me if I'm wrong, we're being asked to move into two areas that we have not heretofore gone. One is that the plaintiff did not do the act complained of, and number two, the act complained of did not occur within the confines of the plaintiff's employment.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yes, I think that's what's being requested here. And I think, you know, the Mr. Sandy mentioned the Hobson's choice, and that language has been used in some of the other decisions here. And the Hobson's choice that the at-will exception has been addressed at has always been in the context of the employer-employee relationship, never outside of that. And I think that makes sense because of the interrelationship between the duties of the employer and the employee with regard to public policy, as opposed to a third person's duties in that regard.
Counsel, I want to follow up on that, and I think it's an important point, so I want to clarify it because I got two impressions of your answer. With regard to the act complained of occurring outside the scope of the employer-employee relationship. Justice Babbage's hypothetical, where the plaintiff here was also a part-time police officer. I heard you to answer that you thought that a cause of action under that fact situation could be maintained for wrongful discharge. Did I understand you correctly?
You did.
So even though the conduct complained of is outside of the zone of the employer-employee relationship, that does not inhibit the ability to maintain a cause of action for wrongful discharge.
Well, I disagree because there.
Okay, that's why I'm not.
Because there is an. Because in the first case, there is an employer-employee relationship. The employee happens to have two jobs.
Mm-hmm. But the conduct complained of is outside the scope of the employer-employee relationship, and Justice Babbage is hypothetical where she's also a part-time officer.
Yes.
So I understood your answer to be a cause of action can be maintained when there is conduct outside of the employee-employer relationship.
Actually, what I said, what I meant to say, if I didn't say it clearly, was that I thought perhaps that could be followed under the current rules and be subject to the summary judgment scrutiny which was proposed in Rockmeyer to keep the number of cases being brought for unlawful discharge to this court to a minimum, which really hasn't worked very well.
And then what's the answer as a matter of law to the summary judgment inquiry?
I'm sorry?
Well, I just need, if this goes to summary judgment, Judge Justice Babbage's factual situation, are you prepared to say as a matter of law that because the act complained of was outside of the scope of employment, that a wrongful discharge action cannot be maintained?
I believe that a lower court looking at that with the current case law, or a court of appeals looking at that, could decide either way.
So you're backing off the original action, which is, I don't see that in a pejorative sense. You're
Justice Bradley has brought out the problem that I have with your answer, because you are trying to get us to expand this at-will doctrine in two important areas.
No, I'm trying to have you not expand.
Or not expand, right.
Please.
Excuse me. He's the bad guy. But it doesn't seem to me you can have it both ways. If you say that the plaintiff, if she does this act of arresting herself, she's arresting Don's wife, if that comes within the scope of the at-will doctrine, and that she can't be fired for that, then it seems to me you have conceded that at least, there's a point here, that you have conceded that to the respect that the plaintiff is asking us to expand this to acts done not within the confines of the employment, you don't find a whole lot of problem with that.
I guess the problem I find is that each expansion begets another expansion. And I suppose in my heart of hearts, as normally a plaintiff's attorney, I would like to say, okay, that's all right to squeeze it out that far. But the problem is that I see no logical stopping place.
I take it you would like to reconsider. I'm not trying to embarrass you. I take it that...
I'll take it back, if that's what you mean.
Right.
Just for clarification, if here the plaintiff not only works at the grocery store, but if this plaintiff were also a part-time officer and made the arrest for drunk driving of the grocery store owner's wife, and the grocery store owner then fired the plaintiff from her job at the grocery store, it's your position that no cause of action could be maintained for wrongful discharge.
The employee in that situation would have to file a complaint which set forth the public policy relied upon and showed some connection between the act and that policy, and then the decision would be made. And under the current law, the matter would be dropped at the motion to dismiss level, as this one was.
There is a public policy that you want government officials to do their job without considering extraneous matters, like whether they'll be fired from a second job because they do their first job. I mean, we agree that that's the public policy, don't we?
Sure.
Okay. Now, if you fire this woman who is a part-time police officer and part-time clerk because she has done her government job, would you agree that that's contrary to the public policy? Even if you won't agree that it should be liable. I mean, it doesn't foster the public policy.
I hope I'm not stumbling here because I'm stupid. I'm trying to articulate this well. The problem is that there's more than one public policy that has to be considered at a time, and there is a public policy of this state that employers have a right to run their businesses. And in effect, what you're doing there is saying because of this public policy, that's the only reason or that's the most likely reason why this person was terminated.
No, because they have to still prove a retaliation. Maybe she's fired because business is bad and he can't afford another person. Maybe he fired him because he's got somebody else in mind that he thinks is going to be better. Perfectly okay. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff here, as you very well know, to show this is retaliation. That's a hard burden, right? You got 2.5 months or so time factor in this case.
And other factual matters that really haven't been presented yet because there's been no discovery.
That's right. So we have to take that out for the moment. We have to assume it's retaliatory in this case for purposes of this motion. Isn't that right?
Yes.
I just think about this, and I asked opposing counsel, you have a time factor here, and this is all these cases, but as long as it's within the statute of limitations, if there is one, hypothetically, but let's say it's not 3 months, it's 3 years. And if the difficulty I want you to expand on this is that there's been a lot of water over the dam in the last 3 years, but if the plaintiff does have the opportunity to come in and prove that, I think it makes this policy, this narrow employee at will, that you can, whether there's good faith, bad faith, you can fire someone. You have a difficulty with the time here. It was only 2.5 months, but if it, let's say it's 3.5 years, and what we say it's okay, you see problems with that?
Sure. I think it's going to encourage, if I don't like to use the word floodgates because that's jargon. But it certainly encourages because all the plaintiff has to do is allege, and then it's a motion to dismiss, and then it may be ruled at the trial court level and the court of appeals level and wind up here before the seven of you again, depending on what new public policy is raised by that plaintiff's lawyer.
And you look at a summary judgment or a motion to dismiss in the light most favorable to the moving party. In other words, that's the statement.
Sure. At our motion to dismiss level, we're not allowed to set forth the factual circumstances that led to this termination, which frankly have nothing to do with what is alleged to have occurred here. Can I just say one other thing? What I don't see is, I understand where you're going, Chief Justice, but when does that line that keeps being moved in one direction become the difference between the public policy exception to the at-will employment rule, and when does it really become good faith and let's get the courts into looking at, was this a good reason or a bad reason for firing this person?
Well, that's what we're exploring here today.
Well, I think you've drawn the line. Let's not move it anymore.
let me give you another hypothetical.
Oh, good.
Well said, counsel.
This goes to the second area that he is trying to expand into, which is this is now an act not done by the employee but by somebody else connected to the employee. And I want to use as the
case. This is where the two nurses
the whistleblower case.
Right. They reported to the regulations board, and they were fired for reporting. And we found, I think unanimously, that that was unlawful discharge because it was their duty to report. Now, let's assume that instead of Hausman and Wright reporting that, Mr. Hausman, the plaintiff's husband reported it, and the nursing home fired Jane Hausman because of the fact that her husband reported it. Would that be actionable?
No, not under the current law, and it shouldn't be.
Counsel, I would guess to all hypotheticals that in any way vary under current law, the answer is no, 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 no. But, of course, as you go through Bushko, as you go through Winkleman, as you go through Hausman, as you go through Kempfer, the response isn't always no, 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 no. The question is, are there principal reasons that fulfill the existing or nuance the existing law? And so that's what we're grappling here. If it's just say no, then we can close these files, fold up our tents, and go home. The question isn't what is under existing law. The question is, should we or should we not expand it? And that's what I need your answers to respond to, because it's easy to say no to under existing
law. Well, and my answer is that you shouldn't, because by doing so, you are forgetting, paying no attention to that other principle, which is the employer's ability to run his business.
I mean, you right now would stand at the podium and say, this court in a 7-0 decision was wrong in deciding Houseman, because Houseman looked at the affirmative duty to report as opposed to the command requirement under Bushko. So your position, if you're consistent with it, is saying this court unanimously was wrong in Houseman. Right?
Okay.
It appears to me that there is no further discourse other than its total employment at will. And the court was wrong in deciding Kempfer. Isn't that correct? I mean, isn't that your position?
I don't think so. The factual circumstances are so different here. The problem is, if it's this idea of the employee plaintiff has to name some public policy that's important. Look at that statute book. How many public policies are in there? And couldn't any creative plaintiff's lawyer come in and say, this is the public policy that was violated, I was fired, I have a cause of action?
Let's take, if I may, continue on Justice Babbage's hypotheticals. I kind of enjoy doing that. Let's take the Houseman case. In the Houseman nursing home case. Oh, and we're all, especially as we're all getting older, we're all concerned about nursing homes.
The older I get, the more
concerned. That's right. Our focus is on nursing homes. And there we had a well-defined public policy protecting residents of nursing homes. In that case, Houseman, under the law, had a specific affirmative obligation to report suspected abuse of the nursing home residents. Indeed, had she failed to report those concerns, she could be subject to criminal prosecution. So let's take that Houseman case just as it is with those public policy concerns. But let's take Justice Babbage's hypothetical and tweak it a bit and say that the Houseman's husband also worked at the nursing home. And Houseman's husband was fired because his wife reported. Should the husband have a cause of action for wrongful discharge?
I don't think so under those circumstances, because that is beginning to sound more like a bad faith type of retaliation than something based on a public policy that intersects the employer-employee relationship.
We have, and I see, what we're trying to do is test, you know, what part you want to maintain strongly, you know, in other words, is it this conduct within the zone or outside the zone of employment? And we tested that, and now I'm testing how strongly you're adhering to, is it just the employee, or can it be the employee's spouse? So in my hypothetical, where under case law there's a clear and well-defined public policy, the violation of the affirmative duty would subject Ms. Houseman to criminal sanctions. And if her husband also worked there, and if the allegations were conclusively proved, shown, and at this stage we take them as true, that he was fired because she reported abuse
of nursing home residents, there's no cause of action for wrongful discharge.
And I think so, and I think the reason is because if you make the exception in this case and say, okay, for the spouse, then the next case that will be up here with two other lawyers standing in front of you will be son, daughter, mother, father, aunt, uncle, you know, there's no stopping place. And you have tried to carve out of these cases that have been in the last 18 or 19 years, you have tried to carve a relatively, and I mean that so, cohesive situation. Now you're going to move way outside that.
Doesn't that get down to the fundamental question of what does this, who or what is this doctrine trying to protect? Is it trying to protect the employee or is it trying to protect the public policy? And what do you think is the answer to that?
Well, the Chief Justice, in one of her opinions, I think it was in, I don't remember which decision it was, in Kempfer, said that there were two goals of a Brockmeyer cause of action, to make the wronged employee whole and to deter employers' violations of public policy. And I just have a little trouble understanding how some other employer in the future is going to be deterred if you expand this rule. You know, are they going to anticipate that their loved one, whether it's wife, son, daughter, best friend, football coach, is arrested for drunken driving? Are they going to anticipate that and fire the person beforehand? I don't think that there's a connect there to the deterrence.
But maybe as an effect on the police officer.
Pardon?
Maybe it's an effect on the police officer, knowing that there is a relationship between the person arrested and a spouse or a loved one. You see, here's my problem with the parade of horribles. You talk about a judge, you talk about a district attorney, all of those people can recuse themselves. As a judge, if I've got a relationship out there, I get out of the case. I have to get out of the case. The district attorney, if it's a case that somehow involves a spouse or a member of his or her family, gets out. The police officer answering a call does not have that opportunity. That police officer has to carry through, whether it's friend or foe, right? And that's why,
supposed to.
That's why I view this as really potentially narrow in scope as a government official. And that may be true of some of the other examples given by Justice Bradley, of the cheese inspector or others who have an opportunity to get out.
Sure, sure. You, the logic then would extend that to any authority figure who cannot recuse themselves.
Right. Who cannot get out.
Is there a hospital in Menominee?
Sure.
Did they ever give blood tests there?
Pardon?
Did they ever give blood tests there for drunk driving?
Quite frequently.
Could the officer have said, I don't think I want to administer this test. I want the arresting officer to take her to the hospital.
I am a former district attorney and I'm a former city attorney, and I know that officers will sometimes say, you do the test, leave me out of it.
An officer doesn't have to arrest for drunk driving, do they?
No. And that's an important distinction here.
But if you're...
If the public policy is let's keep drunk drivers off the road, and we have the implied consent law, you can't get to the test until somebody has made a decision that there's probable cause to believe that the offense has occurred. And that happened in this case and had nothing to do with Frank Bammer.
If Don Williams' son had gone into a bar and was underage, and the bouncer was the husband of Karen Bammer, and the bouncer didn't do something about it. The bouncer could be in trouble, and the bar could be in trouble for violating the law, couldn't it? I mean, there's really no discretion there, is there?
Well, I think there always is discretion on the part of law enforcement officers, or there should be. But yes, under those circumstances, that bouncer could be in trouble with his employer.
What I'm trying to suggest here is that the law enforcement officer might have more discretion than the private bouncer.
I don't know. Because that's comparing police chiefs and police and fire commissions with private employers and their concerns about their insurance rates. I don't know which would have more discretion.
Counsel, the court has peppered you with questions. If you would like to sum up quickly, even though your red light is on, we'd appreciate that, and no one was going to ask you any more questions.
Well, just, and this is reiterating what we've all been addressing here for some time, and that is that in those cases where the rule was the at-will exception was either applied or extended, the Hobson's choice was the Hobson's choice of the employee, not somebody else's Hobson's choice. And in those cases where you refused or denied an extension recovery, were in cases where the Hobson's choice was not of a sufficient level. Riley, the staffing in the juvenile facility, Weinberg, National Guard duty, Tachi, the non-compete question, and Bushko versus Miller, that's where the guy claimed that it was a Chapter 134 violation or perjury. I just feel that further extension under these circumstances either basically says we are now going to switch to a good faith argument, which means that there will be more litigation, it seems to me, of unlawful termination. It's going to lead to an increasing number of cases. Also, one last point. It seems to me that, in effect, this court, I think it was slightly different makeup at the time, but 2.5 years ago, sort of decided this case when the first appeal came up. Bamert 1 came up from LRIC, and the Court of Appeals decision, which affirmed LIRC, the petition for review was denied by you. And there, in effect, what you said was that the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act was designed to protect the status of being married and not the status of being married to a particular person, or in this case, to a person having a particular kind of job. I think the request for extension should be denied, and I think that will balance, as started out in Brockmeyer, both sets of principles and rights, employer and employee.
Thank you, Mr. Steens. Mr. Sander, you're going to do rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. My colleague was asked whether or not we have determined through our legal research whether there's any other state in our union that has expanded the public policy exception of the employment at will doctrine to include spouses. Of course, the answer is no. But the answer is no, not because it's been rejected. The answer is no because it hasn't been addressed to either of our knowledge in any other court in the state. And to me, that infers that this is a factual scenario that doesn't occur with great frequency and therefore would not be a substantial expansion of the doctrine. Secondly, there were some questions again posed about the time period that may elapse between the act of fulfilling the public policy and then the ultimate termination. And that's really a factual dispute that exists in those cases where this court would recognize and has already recognized the public policy exception. Take Houseman. Perhaps Houseman, the Houseman plaintiff, could have been terminated 3 years later, and they believe that it was as a result of their earlier compliance with the law. It's a factual distinction that the defendant can raise to show that, in fact, the termination was not that was not the reason for the termination. And so that already exists, and I don't think from an analytical standpoint that should dissuade the court from making the decision about whether it applies to the spouse or not. Let me respond briefly to the very last assertion, or one of the last assertions by my colleague, about the legislature, the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, and the fact that that was the subject of an earlier appeal. The legislature has chosen, of course, in certain very specific areas, namely the anti-discrimination statutes, to put the brakes on the employment at will doctrine. And there is a marital status discrimination section of that which talks about purely whether you are married or whether you are single, not the identity of a spouse. But there's no mention whatsoever in that act about the legislature's intention to invade otherwise what is a purely common law created scenario, the employment at will doctrine at its base, and then the public policy exception created by this court in Brockmeyer and his progeny. And so the fact that the legislature has not attempted to legislate those areas, I don't think, removes this court's powers as the purveyor of the common law in this regard. And finally, in attempting to draw these admittedly sometimes fine distinctions about who would be allowed a right of action, that's something that this court does, and it does in other contexts. My thought is going to the Bowen versus Lumberman's Mutual case. Not an employment case, but a case where this court was called upon to determine the extent of what persons would have a cause of action as a bystander to a tort. And is it going to be the neighbor that sees somebody get run over by the drunk driver, et cetera, or the friend? And this court chose to make those public policy decisions and say, we're only going to limit it to these people. That doesn't mean that there couldn't have been some harm effectuated emotionally to some other type of person, but there are some limited unique relationships that rise to the level of protection. And I suggest that this court can make a similar public policy distinction as it relates to spouses being covered by this doctrine. Thank you.
Is it fair to say then that the rule, if we allow this cause of action to go forward, the rule of law would be don't fire the spouse of a cop for actions, lawful actions, taken by the cop in the line of duty?
Certainly.
And can we keep it to that?
If this court wanted to, yes. Yes. Because of the uniqueness of the law enforcement function. If that's the line that this court wanted to draw, it certainly could do that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sander, and thank you, Mr. Steens, for an excellent oral argument on a very difficult area of law, which the court has struggled with, as you can see from their questions. So that concludes the argument in 00-2473,